This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This is Cat Radio Cafe, a salon of the arts exploring the creative bounty of New York. I'm listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI, a Pacifica station. Pacifica stands for peace. Broadcasting at 99.5 on your FM dial. Streaming live at WBAI.org and archived at catradiocafe.com, which is becoming quite a really important literary archive, if I say so for Mark Kehoe himself, the guy who has been archiving it. I'm Janet Coleman, and you are?
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. I have a cold, I think, for the new year.
Oh, a cold, yes. You were celebrating with other human beings.
Made a mistake.
Whether you were gathering with them, whatever you were doing.
Yeah.
That's the way to get a cold, by the way.
I might have shook a couple hands, too.
Fortunately, the listeners will not be able to shake your hand or give you a kiss this morning, this afternoon, or any time of day that happens to be, because it's on the radio.
All hands should be stirred, not shaken.
Yes. I believe that's true. Radio being a completely sanitary medium.
Except for this thing. Shouldn't I put alcohol rub on it? Somebody's going to...
I think it's up to the listeners to put alcohol rub on their radios at this point. Because we may be discovering new scientific breakthroughs at the end of this year. Where you will be able to catch a disease from your radio.
I always heard that it was better to get a cold than to have a nervous breakdown. Especially going into the... Well, it's the old year. I can have a nervous breakdown and start up all over again tomorrow.
That's right.
Okay, I think
that'll count as next year's cold, and then it won't count against you for how many colds you had this year.
That's true. I think I'll have a cold and a nervous breakdown.
Well, those are very old-fashioned, aren't they?
Cold and nervous breakdown?
Well, the nervous
breakdown.
The vapors,
you're right.
That's right.
Out of the question.
The whim-whams, huh?
Yeah. Nobody has nervous breakdowns anymore because they take all these drugs to prevent
Absolutely.
Any kind of emotional sensations whatsoever.
They start children out on these drugs early so that they couldn't possibly know that they were having a nervous breakdown because they're so medicated.
They think they're correcting attention deficit disorder with Ritalin. You know, ever try Ritalin yourself?
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I mean, I lost my train
Remember
of thought.
Remember the skit on Saturday Night Live where the woman taking amphetamines, which is really pretty much similar to Ritalin, folds her grocery bags?
Yeah, I think that was in the original, the first season.
I think so.
She was folding those bags and putting them away.
One of the most vivid images ever. Of being on an amphetamine drug and folding your grocery bags. They don't have that many paper bags anymore, so they're harder to fold.
They're going to have to bring them back because some cities are making plastic bags illegal just about.
Yeah, get your green bag.
San Francisco, you know, they're very avant-garde. And
carry your own bag.
Yeah. That's what they do in Europe.
Ooh, Europe.
Yeah.
Freedom fries.
Mm-hmm.
To them. All right. Well, on today's show, you will hear an epilogue to WBAI's recent celebration of Norman Mailer, one we broadcast a week ago Sunday, and which is archived at catradiocafe.com. I urge you to check it out if you missed it. It is really quite an extraordinary group of voices. But today you will hear Pulitzer Prize columnist and author Jimmy Breslin give a holler and legendary actor Rip Torn weigh in on his old friend and fellow improviser Norman Mailer, and you'll also hear an encore airing of Joyce Carol Oates, the great American author's observation on Norman Mailer, and we will conclude with the loose end left over from the political satire show, which will not fit tomorrow. It is Will Durst with the top 10 comedic stories of 2007. So I want to tell a little bit about what happened here with the Mailer show. It was kind of fascinating that Jimmy Breslin, who had been invited to be part of this two-hour celebration, He didn't show up, although he said he would. I reminded him every day. Anyway, the morning after the show, I found this message under my office door. It goes, "Fax to Mailer Memorial Show Station WBAI. I am unable to speak today for two syllables without heavy coughing. I thought it would go away overnight, but it sure got a second run today. I thought about whiskey, but as usual, it betrays you when you need it most. All it did this time was put a barroom smell onto my cough. I will say a prayer for Norman today and speak out lustily for him when able. Regrets, Jimmy Breslin." And a few hours later, our receptionist called to say, this was about a week ago, called to say, "Your friend Elmore is here." Well, there was apparently some confusion about the date all round, and Rip Torn, real name Elmore, had arrived a day late for the show. And he was really interested in setting straight the record about the filming of Maidstone, the film they made in Long Island, that Mailer directed, and the improvised film, which they made in 1968. And he particularly wanted to correct the misinformation about the famous assassination or ear-biting scene, which had been excerpted and widely disseminated on YouTube following Mailer's death and presented as actual rather than acted violence. Also, Rip Torn had a little trouble this day, last Monday, getting past security at 120 Wall Street, since all the building computer holds is names for about 24 hours and they erase the record. So Rip attributed the trouble he had downstairs to his failure to follow the Norman Mailer code of dress. And this was very much on his mind as we sat down to record.
Let's talk about dear old beloved and great Prince Norman. You know, he's kind of like my big brother. I never had a big brother, but he was the closest thing to my big brother. And we were, I don't know why, on 23rd Street and 9th Avenue, we happened to be there. I don't know where he was going or what he was doing. We just happened to be hiding behind, they used to have not these little skinny silver poles, they used to have big trees, you know, creosoted trees, and we were, I'd say we were hiding, but we were behind that. There was a gun battle going up, up from 23rd and 9th up on the west side of the northwest corner there, and it was a guy under the car. They were shooting at four or five guys in suits. I don't know what they were. I don't know if they were a gang. I don't know if they were the police. I don't know who they were. They were shooting at this guy, and there was me and Norman. But he was talking business to me. He was completely ignoring what was going on behind us. I think that's my phone. I got to turn it off. Hello? Okay. I keep turning this thing off. I don't know why it didn't go on. Probably somebody telling me to get up to WB. Anyway. Norman was... He said, "Well, you always dress like a bum, you know." I said, "Well, I was working on the roof, you know." And he said, "You know, you dress like me. You dress in a suit with a vest and a tie, and they'll treat you with respect, you know." And this gun battle's going on, and finally the guy under the car says, "I'm hit. I'm coming out." And he said, "Throw it out." And maybe he had another gun, or maybe he had shot one of them, but when he crawled out, they rushed up and bam, bam, they just killed him instantly. And I said, I never, ever in my life, I'd seen people die. I'd been an officer in military police in the Army. And I said, but I never saw somebody go so quickly from alive to death. Maybe he had another gun. Maybe he shot one of them. I don't know what it was. So Norman said, shut up, let me handle this. And they came up because he was in a suit. So the cops came up and Norman said, no, we didn't see anything. We didn't hear anything. And they say, aren't you that guy, that writer guy, you know, what's his name, Norman? Yeah. He said, yeah, okay. So can we leave now? Who's this guy? He said, he works for me. He was so quick, you know. I mean, he's just quicker than, you know, lightning. So we walked about 10 feet away from it, and he says, what's happening with Terry's thing, that Easy Rider thing? Because it was a script. I mean, Terry wrote it. I mean, all those other things to the contrary. The other guy couldn't even write a letter. That's what Terry said. At any rate, I said, I'm not doing that. He said, why not? I was supposed to be part of the damn venture, I said, but they will only pay me scale and they don't give me a back end deal, so what the hell I want to do that for? He says, what do you want? I says, $3,500. He says, why $3,500? And I pointed toward 10th Avenue and 23rd, where the bank still is. I said, the government has a lien against my bank account, and I can't even get a residual check. He said, oh, well, I'll give you $3,500. That's okay. What's the deal? He said, oh, you pay my half-brother and stir up some conflicts, and at the end, take me out. I says, not for real. Aren't we going to do some more work together? He said, make it look real. And so that's what it was. That whole thing they're showing on YouTube was a planned thing between Penny Baker and Norman and me.
But he that was his scenario, in other words. But he
well, he was supposed to be. We had talked about it. I have to say about him that he, you know, he's a great boxer. He knew every trick in the book and every dirty trick. I saw him that night that Bobby Kennedy was killed. We were talking about this venture then, to do a film about assassination. We were supposed to, he explained to me that all the other people that got in the race early, that they were stalking horses and feel out the water, and that Bobby was going to run, I was on. I'm supposed to do a thing at one of those big halls there on around 45th and something,
Town Hall.
What was the name of that?
Town Hall, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we were going to do a skit where he was going to play the Russian premier and I was going to play the American president as the fundraiser. So it didn't work out that way. At any rate, I went and did the thing, Maidstone, and Harris Shula and myself and Penny Baker, and there were a number of people that had the right to create scenes in the film. And like all the cat house scenes with the women, I did a lot of those. And we could call for a camera anytime and set up a scene. But at the end of the film, I was getting ready to go up to Stockbridge to start rehearsals on the Cuban thing, written and being directed by Jack Gelber. And the night before that, I was getting ready to packed up and ready to drive out of there. We were at the end of Long Island. And we had a kind of a rushed up meeting with all the people that had shot scenes. and there was nothing in it anywhere that approached the sense of an assassination, which was what the film was about, an improvisational film. So I sat there looking at all those people, and here I am again. And he said, well, why are you getting me here on the hot seat? And he said, well, what do you think you were hired for? You know, I'm always the heavy. My darling daughter Katie, when she was in school, said, Dad, please don't play any more bad guys. I'm just getting a hard time at school, and I want to tell you, I've done much better with comedy. Comedy gets you a better table. So, and I've won a lot of awards.
Amazing, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I won't play no more bad guys. But there I was. I was on the hot seat. You got to do it, you know. So I went through and I talked through all of it with all the cameramen and all the adjunct or associate directors on that film, and there was nothing. I said, well, what about this thing? And what about that? And what about this? And then I said, because dear Barney Rossett was, I thought he was one of the sponsors of the film, and I said, I guess Barney's going to take a bath because there's no film. I mean, it's a lot of stuff and interesting stuff, but no central theme what it was supposed to be about assassination. And they said, no, it's not Barney, it's Norman. He sold his interest in the Village Voice to raise the money for this film. So well, he's like my big brother, you know. I dearly loved him.
We used to see you in the village.
You know, he was a lot of fun, you
on
know.
On the back of your motorcycle, tearing around the
rim. Come watch yourself, buddy. So we called up Jack and a guy, whoever was a producer, and I told him I have to do this obligatory scene. I'm going to be a day late for rehearsal. Gee, I didn't know what shape I was going to be in, but I didn't. So the sun was setting. We went and we showed Penny Baker, and Norman and I discussed the scene, and he agreed. But just, he just was never a literal type of person. You know, just so he agreed, you know what he was going to do. He was, you know. I thought it was bam, he's just going to fall down, play bang, bang, you know, like in, you're playing cowboys and Indians and not Norman. So I said, you got to send Beverly and the kids away. And he did. But at the last minute, he called for them to come back.
Why didn't
But they
that?
Didn't get there till at the end of that fracas. But basically, let me get away from this and talk about that night of Bobby Kennedy's. There was a guy with dark glasses on at Casey's restaurant. Why do these villains always wear dark glasses? And, you know, and he was talking to this huge big guy that I call Sailor. I mean, he looked almost as tall as that door. He's about 6'5" or something. Norman said, well, you keep calling him Sailor. I said, he looks like the champion of the fleet. So he kept trying to get into an argument, and Norman kept pushing him away. And then finally, Buzz Farber went outside with him. And he had a very expensive watch, but he should have taken it off before he went outside. As he started to take the watch out, Sailor clocked Buzz and knocked him down. And he kept getting up, and he kept getting knocked down. And Norman just, even though he was good friends, he kept watching it. And finally Norman got into it. I said, don't get into it with that guy. I said, he's a professional. Norman got into it. And he reached his thumbs into this guy's mouth and hit him like a bulldog. And he said, "I'll." You know what I mean? That guy was immobilized.
How did he know to do that?
That's what Norman did. I mean, he knew every trick in the book. That's what I'm telling
you.
And not only was he a good boxer, he had that huge guy like that. Mm-hmm. And I said, "The police are on the way. Let's get out of here," you know. And finally, there were about six or seven patrol cars came in. Norman shoved that big guy away, and we went inside the bar. And again, he just said, "We didn't see nothing. We don't know nothing." But he was wearing the suit and the tie. He always looked like a man of respect.
And you're listening to legendary actor, Academy Award nominee and six-time Emmy nominee for his role as Artie on the Larry Sanders Show. This is Rip Torn reflecting on Norman Mailer, with whom he worked on several productions of the Deer Park, several productions of the Actors Studio, and most famously co-starred with Mailer on the improvised film Mailer directed, the Deer Park. When he talks about Beverly Bentley, he's referring to Norman Mailer's fourth wife, and when he talks about Norris, he's talking about Norris Mailer, his widow, Norman Mailer's widow and sixth wife, with whom he stayed for the last 31 years of his life. Rip Torn.
The one that we did down there, that scene, I said that in the West, or whenever the West kept going further and further away, but the weapon of last resort, if a bear is eating you or a horse is kicking you to death or something, is to bite the ear. Mm. And so in that scene, he had hold of mine. You can't hear that. And I said to him, well, I got blamed for that too, you know. But I said to him, which you can't hear in that scene that's being shown over and over again, I said, "Dad," I said, "I need this ear to work with." And he said, "Oh, okay." Gave it another grind. And in the film, you can see when Beverly says, "Norman, you're hurt," he says. "He's hurt worse than I am." And he reaches out and grabs my ear, gives it a he didn't want anything to be thought about in that fight scene that we had, which was the end of the film and the equivalent of an assassination, that he was hurt worse than me. He's hurt worse than I am.
That's him.
Well, that's Norman.
Would he have become a good actor? Could he have been, or was he too?
He's a great actor.
He was a great actor.
Yeah, he's a great actor. I mean, he was a life actor. I mean,
yeah.
He
jumped.
He liked
line.
Improvisation.
Yeah.
He didn't. But, you know, I mean, I had this argument with him, you know, if you're on a football team, you're going to have a football play, you have to rehearse it and rehearse it and rehearse it. He just thought that, I think he once said to me that repetition causes cancer.
You might be right. You've been right about a lot.
Well, I was doing a thing with Norris. I mean, a play one time, and four or five people had tried to do it, and I went back to the original script, And I directed it. Norman said, well, you're a great stager. I'm a great director, but you're a great stager. I said, what the hell is staging got anything to do with directing? So I went off to get some food or something like that. Came back, and I had staged it, directed it with Norris. And Norman had come in at the very last minute and taken all the everything and rearranged it, you know. So, but I told them that I was a member of Actors Equity and that was doing this under the auspices of my union, and you could not change anything in our union 30 minutes before a performance. And so they put it back. And it was a great success.
What was it, the deer part?
I thought Norris wrote it. So, But who knows? I mean, I can never find out. But it was about a guy who was gay who falls in love with a woman in a glass box that's doing that strip thing and gets a big boner and. But they never went forward with it. I mean, it was a huge. I mean, people were packing in there to the Actors Studio to see it, but they didn't go forward with it. And I think somebody else took the idea and did a play like that. So it was never finished. And then I was supposed to. I have my own theater in Lakeville, Connecticut, but we were always supposed to go over to Provincetown. What was the other thing that I did with Norman? Why we were in Vietnam, I played the kid in that. DJ, I think his name was. Aunt, I said, that's a non-union. I was a sponsor of that theater, but I said, and people in my family work there, but I said, I can't work there. It's non-union. He said, oh, you're just being chicken. I said, no, I'm not. I said, I don't work in movies anymore, or television. That's the only, I got to keep that card. I said, why don't you do it instead of doing it at Act 4, I said, do it at the, Provincetown Art Association. That's a big house. I think there are about 600 people in there. So we went and did a benefit there. Even then, I was brought in by the union there.
Wanted you to scab, huh?
Well, you know, I said, well, it was, you know, it's Art Association, and we're just doing a benefit, but I have to come up and ask permission to do that and did that. But I flew in. And Beverly was in that one, and I said, how are you going to do it? Because I must have been, in my 30s then. I said, I'm DJ. I said, I'm 18, but I look like I'm 40. And they all laughed. I said, this is my mom. I says, whatever her name was in the thing. I said, she's 40. She looks like she's 15. You know, so they got a big laugh. And so it was good. That's the way it is. And I know when I was doing the rehearsal, the guy that was head of he said, you're terrible. That's what they always say when you're rehearsing, you know. That's like coming up to a football team when they're scrimmaging and trying to get the play together and say, you're terrible. You know, you have you have to work at it. Of course, Norman always just wanted an improv. I think for film, that's right.
In a way.
But in on the stage, you have to. That was the other thing, that when we were doing Deer Park, that the actors were going crazy, and because he kept changing and rewriting and everything, and we're getting ready to open, and they wanted to set it. And so I got to be the spokesman, like always. And so Norman got up there, and what used to be the theater de l'Est called the Lucille Ortel, and he was up on the balcony like Napoleon, had his foot up there on the rail and looking down to us on the stage. He says, "So what's this about? Has anybody got anything to say? How about you, you Marlowe? You got anything?" "Oh, no, not me, Norman." "Nobody." So I spoke, and he said, "Oh, yeah, he's always the troublemaker. Here he is, you know." And then Beverly just cussed him, "You told," says, "you put Rip up to this, and now you're hiding behind the furniture, you know." But I said, "We got to set it. You know, we're going to open. You have to, it's just like a football team. You can't go out there with a half knowing your plays. You have to rehearse the thing." And but he just always wanted to keep it. And so
you want to get cancer.
That's good. That's kind of great. just like that play I did there at the Actor's Studio, where he rearranged all the furniture and everything. And I just put it back the way it was supposed to be, so the way we had rehearsed it.
Was that the one with Norris, the Actor's Studio one?
I think she talked about that. Yeah, I was up there on 44th Street, the Actor's Studio. Mm-hmm. But in the thing, Buzz and Mickey Knox and those guys, you know, they just, I don't know what the hell he did with them, I mean, but they were telling him that I kicked his butt and he looked like an old washerwoman. So he didn't do the last scene in the movie, Maidstone. 2 years later, he called me up and said he wanted me to come up to the office that he had where he was making films. And he was very nervous. He had a lot of change. They didn't, just before cell phones, he had a phone on the wall there, a pay phone, so people wouldn't come up there and just wreck him by using a free phone. So he was dropping his change. He said, "I know that I told you to, you know, we would direct this together and we would edit it together, but I want to edit it myself." And since he was dropping his chains, I said, "Well, that's okay. It's your nickel." And I said, "You all right with that?" I said, "Yeah, sure." I said, "But how about my $3,500? He said, "Didn't you ever get paid?" I said, "No, sir." "You didn't?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "We'll fix that." And he went over to the, he was calm then. He wasn't dropping his change or anything. He put the nickels and dimes and quarters in there and called over. He says, "Go over to the Time Life building." I think it was Peter Hansen was the guy. "He's going to cut you a check." And thanks, boss. I said, "What a champ." That's what he was to me.
Yeah.
He was a champ.
That was Rip Torn, one of America's greatest character actors and directors, talking about working with his old friend Norman Mailer and the making of the improvised movie Mailer Cooks Up, and in which Rip Torn co-starred and co-directed Maidstone, circa 1968. This is Cat Radio Cafe, and I'm Janet Coleman, and you are
David Dozer,
the displaced playwright. Turning now to a little bit of a reprieve of a piece recorded also on Norman Mailer with the great American author Joyce Carol Oates, who is also the Roger S. Berlin Professor of the Humanities with a program in creative writing at Princeton University, where she's taught since 1978. Besides being author of voluminous numbers of novels, story collections, and critical reviews, Joyce Carol Oates serves as associate editor for the Ontario Review, which is a literary magazine, and the Ontario Review Press, a literary book publishing company, both of which are edited by her husband, Raymond J. Smith. This interview took place December 14th of this old year, 2007. Joyce Carol Oates, thinking back to yourself as a young writer, can you give your sense of Mailer as a literary force and tell us on what that impression might have been based?
I think that for writers of my generation, Norman Mailer exerted the kind of power that Hemingway probably exerted for Norman Mailer in his generation.
Mm-hmm.
That obviously when we look at American history and from a distance, we can see that Norman Mailer was in some ways descended from Hemingway. In some ways, not always, because Hemingway didn't have the intellectual or philosophical predilections and passions that Norman eventually developed. But I think as a public presence, that Norman Mailer perhaps even consciously modeled himself after Ernest Hemingway, who is the great world-famous American writer of Norman's generation.
Right, and I've seen you name Hemingway and Faulkner as one of your own literary influences, never have seen you mention Mailer. But do you find any sort of kinship based on, say, both having written about Marilyn Monroe or your mutual interest in boxing or both, in fact, being so very prolific?
Well, I guess these are intriguing questions which I've never really thought of exactly because Norman Mailer is my contemporary, though older than I am,
mm-hmm.
but I probably didn't think of him as an influence. When I first became aware of literature, I was really quite young, say 12, 13 years old, and in high school, and then I was reading Hemingway and Faulkner and James Joyce, and
mm-hmm.
the writers that have the most influence on us are the writers we read when we're very young.
Yeah.
And I think for Norman also, Hemingway was an early influence, though his style really doesn't owe much at all to Hemingway. It's a very freewheeling and impressionistic and adventurous and risky style of a kind that Hemingway would not have attempted. But to get back to your question, the boxing writing that Norman has done, particularly on Muhammad Ali, is so wonderful. It's just brilliant. It's very visceral and very sympathetic with the subject. One feels that the writer is right in there with the subject, and it's up close, very intense. The kind of writing that I've done about boxing in most cases is much more analytical and at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say necessarily that it's a feminist stance because I don't think that's really a helpful word, but probably because I am a woman, I'm looking at the phenomenon of boxing and also the phenomenon of Marilyn Monroe
definitely.
In a very different way.
Yes.
And Norman writes about Marilyn Monroe as a fantasy figure, as a female archetype who has particular relevance to him in his imagination and his fantasies, whereas I never wrote about,
right.
I thought of her as Norma Jean Baker,
right.
and she seemed like somebody I might have gone to school with and certainly someone that my mother might have gone to school with. I never saw her, the Marilyn Monroe icon or archetype, as anything more than just a very commercial kind of fantasy, almost a destructive fantasy. I was never involved in the fantasy of Marilyn Monroe, but only in the historical reality of mm-hmm. Norma Jean Baker. So Norman and I came to that subject from very different angles, and I think very interestingly different angles.
Very much. Did you ever talk about it?
No, we only met a few times, and the last time we met, I went up to Provincetown where there was a wonderful staged reading of a play of mine, and Norman and Norris came to the reading, and I think Norris Mailer has been involved with this theatrical group in Provincetown, and that's the connection. Then we all went out to dinner afterward, and Norman and I talked about various things. He was one of the great conversationalists. Just did you ever speak with him?
Yes.
I
met him when I was a very young kid.
And you know all these things. Well, he is so charismatic and so wonderful, up close, one-on-one, talking to a small table of people. Very warm, very funny. I think the stances that Norman took in his earlier writing, or maybe in the 1950s, made him seem so aggressive and even belligerent, provocative and provoking. And that was something of a public stand. I never knew him in that way. I really responded to him as a human being, one-on-one, and felt that probably the majority of people never understood that Norman had a wonderful, wonderful sense of humor.
Oh, yeah. Playful a person.
So playful, but he often seemed to be giving sermons or speeches, you know, making provocative statements to stir people up. And I think they were not perceived as playful.
You know, our mutual friend Edmund White mentioned that at your meeting with Mailer in Provincetown, you'd mentioned to him that Mailer apologized to you for not reading, I don't know, I guess every single one of your books, which gets us again to the question of your mutual prolificness. Any understanding, mutual understanding there in the love of writing?
Well, that's a very good question. I've been thinking a lot lately about the difference between Norman Mailer and another friend, Bill Styron.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between these two very gifted men of their generations, extremely honored by the public and by critics, and how differently they led their lives and how different their personalities were, how tragic Bill Styron's life turned out to be in the sense that he had lost all faith in himself as a writer. Norman never lost faith, ever. He didn't seem to. Of course, maybe Norris saw a different side of him.
Mm-hmm.
But he just exuded this air of a kind of playful confidence to plan a 7-part novel about Hitler, you know, in his mid-80s, to have that kind of energy and confidence and, I would say, optimism about the future is extraordinary.
Yeah.
I think the sense of despondency and failure and loss of energy that we see in Bill Styron is possibly more common that the writer or the artist runs down, burns out, loses faith, and perhaps is even feeling somewhat suicidal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't speak really for Bill Styron, but I know that he lost faith in himself. Mm-hmm. He found it very, very hard to write. Norman must have found writing both a challenge and difficult and yet bracing and invigorating. I have to say that for myself, I often find it very challenging and very exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And there are days when I just don't feel that what I've done is adding up to much. And those are sort of dark days. Maybe Norris will write a little memoir about her life with this extraordinary person, because it would be like living with Picasso.
It was a great suggestion, and I hope she takes you up on it.
Well, it's like living with Picasso,
yeah.
Because here you have a mercurial personality, very, very strong, began his career virtually as a boy, through the decades, changing, taking up different subjects, veering this way, veering that way, you know, doing this. And it's sort of astonishing just to see the transformations of a person like Norman Mailer, and to know in more detail. I think Norris could write something very beautiful and also very revealing. Because we have Bill Styron's memoir on depression, Darkness Visible, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Darkness Visible, yeah. Beautiful, beautiful title. Mm-hmm. And we sort of see what that's like. So anyway, this is just very informal, something off the top of my head. But I think people would love to read that.
Well, you know, Mailer is often seen as so protean and various, and yet you deciphered a kind of through line in his work in one of your journal entries of the journals of 73 through 82, and talked about his faith in the teleological unconscious. Can you describe what you meant by that? I know it's complicated essay question, really, but do you think it applied this faith in the teleological unconscious consistently through the next 25 years or so of his work?
Yes, I think Norman always had that. I think deep down inside he had a kind of religious ferocity, a messianic feeling, mm-hmm. that was driven by passion, not in no ways a conventional religious feeling, obviously, but more the passions of conviction. I would relate him to D.H. Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
the messianic passion person who can be very annoying, very disruptive, who annoys other people who don't have that kind of attitude toward life, who are more analytical or cooler or more cynical or just don't have quite the optimism. By teleological unconscious, I meant that Norman would say that the unconscious of humankind, the collective unconscious, has a unity and a purpose that consciousness may not acknowledge, that there is some reason for us existing. Nietzsche would have said we are a transitional species and we're moving toward what he called the Übermensch,
mm-hmm.
or the superior human being. Norman may have even been in that Nietzschean tradition.
Yes.
And I think D.H. Lawrence was in that tradition. And if you bear what they're saying, if you lay it there and expose it sort of on the top of a table, it doesn't seem very convincing, because it depends upon faith and dark, unspeakable passions, things that actually can't be talked about. But we hear these passions when we listen to music. And we see these passions in the faces of people who are caught up in religious ecstasy, or maybe even in suicide bombers who are willing to kill themselves for a belief that means so much to them. A long time ago, Norman wrote that very controversial essay about the white hipster,
mm-hmm.
and he got in a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he was always getting into trouble. But maybe today, if he were younger, he might have looked at the suicide bombers, those people who seem so mad and crazy to the rest of humankind, but that they found something that they feel worthy of dying for. And that's, for most of us, just extraordinary.
He was equally interested in the energy of the dark side as the light. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's what I meant by the teleology.
Mm-hmm.
The teleological unconscious, that we're driven to do things by instinct. Obviously, the most evident instinct is to reproduce the species. The sexual mm-hmm. drives are the most basic and immune to reason,
mm-hmm.
quite immune to reason. Nobody can talk anybody out of these feelings. And those instincts are dark and deep. They keep us alive. They keep us going. And when we lose faith in them, then we are ready for suicide. We've sort of lost touch with our deeper selves. Norman had his finger on the pulse,
yep.
of these things, and I think writing about Hitler was a way for him to tap into the darker, satanic, the underside of humanity. Like, Hitler didn't come out of nowhere. He represented something in his era and something in our time that's in the unconscious.
Well, I want to thank you so much. I realize we could go on for hours because as fascinating as Mailer is, he deserves to be talked about. And you are tremendously engaging on the subject. I hope you write more about him.
Well, I probably will. I have to say that as soon as Mailer died, the kinds of remarks made about him in the press I did not think were helpful or deep enough or worthy. I thought there was a lot of sniping. I was shocked at the shallowness and stupidity of some of the remarks. I really was repelled by a lot of what came out of people's mouths, that people who are not really worthy to make these statements about him. Mm-hmm. I don't know how other people felt, but I really was kind of disgusted by some of it.
I concur.
Yeah, well, I hope that Norris didn't see some of that.
Well, we were trying to reverse that on this program.
I just think that people talk very quickly, and they were jealous of him and envious of his powerful image in the world, and they weren't up to dealing with him.
This is Cat Radio Cafe. I'm Janet Coleman. You are...
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. And you were just listening to Joyce Carol Oates talking about Norman Mailer, the great, late great American author. And if you are interested in hearing more about Norman Mailer from his contemporaries and family and friends and other authors, I do urge you to go to the website, catradiocafe.com. Scroll down to the next hour. You'll see Mailer's picture in there. It is a two-hour presentation of a commentary by his widow, Norris Church Mailer, his editor, Jason Epstein, filmmaker D.A. Pennybaker, whom Rip Torn talked about, made the movie Maidstone, John Buffalo Mailer, Mailer's youngest, wonderful son, Peter Olson, his wonderful nephew, Mailer's nephew, Joyce Carol Oates, slightly abbreviated version of this interview you heard today, and the great Irish-American author Frank McCourt. And now for this end of the year, tying up every loose end there is and racing out the clock, this, our great political satirist, Will Durst, too late for the, by a hair, by a running few minutes there, missed the CCCP's last show, the Christmas Coup Comedy Player and the Monthly Laughing Nightmare, so we play now Will Durst with the top 10 comedic stories of 2007.
Hey guys, Will Durst here to talk about the top 10 comedic news stories of the year, which are as different from the top 10 legitimate news stories of the year as peppermint mini marshmallow Fruit Loops are from cold porridge. For instance, the Pakistani government transition didn't make our list. Why? Because it has the humor quotient of cider vinegar foot baths. Subprime mortgage crisis? Yeah. Right. Rusty nail through the bottom of your Reeboks, funny. Myanmar? Virginia Tech? You see my point. So let's go my route, shall we? Here's the stories of 07 that were the most lampoonable. Number 10. Jimmy Carter called President Bush the worst president ever. And by the very nature of that statement, that would have to include Jimmy Carter. Number 9. David Petraeus, the Surgeon General, claimed that Iraq's government is paralyzed by petty partisan squabbling. So maybe they are getting a hang of an American-style democracy. Number 8. Hillary Clinton asks the public to help pick her official campaign songs. Some songs she didn't nominate, the theme from Shaft, Devil with Blue Dress, and The Bitch is Back. Number 7. Demonstrating the concept of free speech in America, both Ahmadinejad and Bush speak at the UN on the same day. Think of it, a religious fanatic who sponsors secret prisons and has antagonized the entire world, and an Iranian, both addressing the General Assembly. Number 6. Rudy Giuliani tried to espouse traditional family values on the campaign trail. And the fact that he's had three wives just means he's extra traditional. Number 5. Karl Rove has left the building. Yes, proof positive that Satan and the Pillsbury Doughboy have more than a passing acquaintance, has exited stage right. Number four, Mitt Romney's OA campaign has flip-flopped so much, he's in danger of triggering a stage four John Kerry alert. His campaign ad should close with, "I'm Mitt Romney, and I both approve and disapprove of this ad." Number three, Paris Hilton was offered community service, but the community declined. Number two, Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, fined $250,000 paid for by the Scooter Libby Defense Fund, which you and I know as Halliburton. And the top news story for the year, for comedic purposes, is gay Idaho Republican Senator Larry Craig, who quit. He isn't gay, and he didn't quit. Should have gone with restless leg syndrome defense. And that's it for this year. Expecting much better next year. For the CCCB, I'm Will Durst. Happy New Year, everybody.
And this here coming up, our version of Auld Lang Syne, Through the Windows of Cars. This is Jackie and Roy, Jackie Kane, Roy Crawl. Music by Roy Crawl. Lyric by Fran Landisman. Well, Happy New Year, David Dozer.
Happy New Year, Janet Coleman.
And at least we get a new president.
We do?
I hope so.
If we're going to go ahead with those elections, let's see if we can get through the Ohio, Iowa. Is that where we are?
We're in Iowa
this weekend.
All night long. The whole wonderful night
Iowa-focused New Year's.
So have a great celebration, everyone. We will see you next year. And week. Next week, next year.
Next week, next year. Coming soon.
Hey listener, did you know that when you make a pledge during our drives or make any donations before or after our drives, you and your employer can help support WBAI? That's right. Simply ask your employer whether they have a matching gift program, submit your request to them, they'll send us the paperwork. The paperwork should be submitted to WBAI Subscriptions Department, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005.
Cauer mediodía, dice que así el hambre engaña y cuando cae la noche baja a bailar a la tasca y bailar y bailar y...
Hello, welcome to the Dawn, playground for the new power generation. There are over 500 experiences to choose from. Here's a sample.
As we approach the 50th birthday of the artist we all know and love as Prince, you are cordially invited to join the girls and the boys of the New Boogie Groove here on WBI in New York City, 99.5 on your FM dial, as we continue our long-standing on-air celebrations for this legendary genius. Tune in at 7 p.m. until midnight, Saturday, January 5th, 2008. That's 7 p.m. until midnight, Saturday, January 5th, 2008. Make sure you're not late.
when Venus is trining Jupiter and you want to celebrate, tune in to Sister from Another Planet every Friday night from 10 p.m. to midnight here on WBAI 99.5 FM. I am the Sister from Another Planet, Andrea Clark, playing the best progressive music from Brixton to Brooklyn. Every Friday night, 10 p.m. to midnight, right here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Revolutionary love.
We sincerely apologize. WBAI would like to acknowledge our many delays in getting the previous Fund Drive premiums to you in a timely manner.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.